This is the Gingerbread Man, and I'd like to welcome you to my home. Today, we're going to be discussing a couple hot topics and things on the top of my mind. I guess first off, I'm home today. I'm supposed to be at work, so I've been trying to stay busy, doing a bunch of housekeeping. I have these things throughout the week that like I can't get to, but they like linger in the back of my mind. And so I've been trying to make efforts and figure out better ways to, so I'm not making any efforts, but today I made effort, you know, like, it was like, I wanted to figure out, I just financed a car, so I have some warranty on it that helps me pay for a lot of things in case things break down, and the car happens to be a manual, which means that it's very likely I'm going to break shit because I'm not used to a manual, and I'm still learning the gears. And like, it doesn't cover my clutch, but I can still do a couple other things. And, you know, yeah, just like, so that's been like every day it'll come up in my head and I'm like, wait, am I fucking my car up? And like, cause you have to schedule maintenance along certain time periods or else, you don't get the coverage and then you have to pay out of your pocket and that just sucks, you know? And hands down, it's a very difficult decision for me to want to finance a car. I've never took on debt before, and this is the first time that I've ever actually had real debt that I've owed. You know, I owe $10,000. I dropped $4,000 on it immediately, you know, but still, you know, and like the finance thing, like on the bill itself, it tells you exactly how much you're spending per day, you know, and so like with interest every day, my bill goes up $1.20. And so like that makes me like nauseous just to know that like that's just extra money that I have to pay on it. And so that's like almost $400 a year if I didn't pay on it, which I'm going to pay on it. So hopefully that number's going to go down. But interest is a bitch. You know, I got 5 years until I'm supposed to have it out. And I think I could pay it off in 2.5 to 3 years if I use tax money. And then I can be debt free again. And hopefully by that time I'll just be really good at the car and it won't be broken at that point. I'll just have a good car. No, that was the plan. I was done being stressed and fretting about having shitty cars. Because for the longest time, what I did, you know, I like to say that I was a recycler. You know, I was like a decomposer of cars. So I'd go find shitty cars and then kill them, you know, and ride them till they die. And, you know, that was okay for a while. But every time your car fucks up and then you don't have any way to get to work, and I'm a single father, so I desperately need to have access to be able to get him places and to get food and do whatever is necessary with children. And like, what if your kid breaks his leg? Are you gonna take him to the hospital on a bus? That's not gonna happen. You know, that anxiety, like, it's necessary. And so every time my car would break down, I would be in this fucked position where I'm just desperately trying to get rides everywhere, and you know, and like Facebook Marketplace is a nightmare looking for those shitty cars, and you end up getting into 25 cars and they're all over the place and none of it makes sense because I'm not a car person. I don't understand these complex systems. You know, I can hold a lot of things in my head, but that's not one of them. So yeah, paying that shit off. You know, my bill is 140. I set my account at 250, so I'm paying 100 more than I need to. I'm just trying to be as proactive as physically possible to get rid of this debt, because debt, I feel like, is one of the biggest evil monsters in this world. But yeah, COVID sucked. I've been realizing I still don't have my sense of smell. It's been a month and I still can't smell anything. And that's incredibly depressing, especially being a marijuana smoker. But I don't know. It's messed up a lot of my routines and the flow of my head. And that's more distressing to me than any physical attribute of a sickness that you could claim or call on it. And that was that. But on to the show. So I'm just going to talk about what I'm reading and what I'm thinking about this week, because that seems to be one of the easiest ways to do it. So I'm reading a book called Paul Feyerabend, and he wrote this amazing book called Against Method. And his main bumper sticker that I've pulled out so far is that he calls it intellectual anarchy, where he says that anarchy is a poor system for governing men, which is like, politics, to have an anarchistic system could, well, I don't know if it's impossible. I like the idea of non-governmental communes, but the system itself could eat itself, and anarchy might not be the best way to govern people, but within one's own inner mind, intellectual anarchy, that's advantageous. And like, just picture all these theories, that all these schools of thought that you could picture out there. And I think I'm gonna tell an allegory after this one. I'll probably tell it many times. But every school of thought's like a kingdom, like a certain type of science. Science is such an overarching category, and it's competitive. So there might be one school of science that's in competition to another school of science. And one school of science might have more accreditability, and the other one might be thought of as hoodoo, And then over time, theology and things that aren't scientific become science. Like astronomy, looking at the stars for a long time was pure philosophy because nobody had any way to experiment or look at it. And then the telescope came about, which is what I'll get to. But for a long time, it was just thinkers thinking about the sky and making up ideas. And then over time, astronomy is a full-blown science now. You have luminosity, and you have these amazing space programs, and you have these amazing telescopes in the sky, what's it called? I can't think of it right now. Starts with an H. Hubble. Yeah, there we go. It's just like Hubble, that's staring off into the radio background of the universe. And like, it's just insane shit. And like, some of these ancient thinkers, like Galileo was back in the 1600s, and Locke, it was back in the 1600s too. I don't know how close they were together, but Locke was talking about aliens, and that's fascinating to me because you have these thinkers theorizing aliens, and they really had no concept of even if the Earth was moving or not. And so Paul, he goes on to he's using the story of Galileo as his framework the entire time through his whole book to basically rib on methodized groupthink, is basically how I think about it, which is the opposite of intellectual anarchy, where you take on prescriptions of ideas and nobody's thinking for themselves at all anymore. And everybody's basically just a slave to these different kingdoms of thought. So he uses the story of Galileo and Copernicus, and I was actually way off for a large amount of the time, unfortunately, where I was confused because Galileo was trying to prove movement of Earth, but he still wanted to say that the Earth was like that the solar system was geocentric, where the Earth is the center. I guess he was trying to prove rotation, if anything. And Copernicus was trying to prove the heliocentric, where the Earth moves around the sun, where the Earth isn't the center of the universe. And I think a lot of Galileo's bent comes from his need to be religious and theological. He was aiding to the church, and he obviously cowed out to the church in the end, when they got mad about his heretical ideas. And so he's criticizing Galileo because of that attachment to the state, because it's like he almost had good ideas and he could have done something amazing, but his need to soothe his rulers, his authorities, his ideological authorities, that got in his way. And that was the major criticism that Feyerabend has the entire time. And I think that's what he was getting at. But one amazing little allegory I'm going to try to put out, he talks about like a ship moving. And imagine that you could put your hand up in the air with a magical pen and trace a line behind the ship as it moves, and it goes 1,000 kilometers from one place to the next, and say that that river was completely straight or whatever, just to make it pretty. And if you were to get a bird's eye view and hover above, it would look like a straight line, or at least like an arc, according to Galileo, because he believed in the globe, I think. And so that perfectly straight line, even though the boat's going over perturbations and going over, waves, and it might have to go around rocks, but from far enough away, that line's going to look relatively straight, which I'm still digging into the meaning of what he was getting at there. And then he goes, it takes it a step further, and he's like, imagine that you have an artist on a ship and he's doodling on a piece of paper. And I guess in my mind, for the thought experiment, I kind of imagine like a shadow of everything the artist does following behind the ship, like if he had laid it up in the air behind the ship. And so as he's doodling, he has this doodle on the paper, but it leaves an after image. And if you were to go up and look at that after image, you would still see a straight line and that relativity of straightness, even though there's the minor little bits. And in fact, with all things considered, those little minor bits, that line would be straighter than the actual movements of the boat itself over the water and whatnot. And then he goes, he's like, everything inside the boat is its own little relative motion area. And for the artist on the boat, even though the boat's moving, everything that happens on the boat is accessible to that motion, and the artist is able to draw. And this argument was in contest to the church's argument at the time, where they imagine you have this gigantic stone tower that's like 150 feet tall, and it's really tall. And if you were to drop a ball from the top of that tower, because if the earth was rotating or in motion, the church said the ball would end up following an arc and it would travel further away from the base of the tower. It would never land at the base of the tower. And Galileo says, well, what about if you're on a boat? And it makes the argument just completely absurd. I like that. And it's just like, how many little arguments do we use that make sense in the modern day that will argue out? And the historical context that's necessary to be able to look at some of these ideas. You know, like, even as a criticism of Galileo, he was using arguments and ideas that would be understood at the time. And he was able to convince people of motion. And then Copernicus took it a step further, you know. But it's really interesting to glean all these little ideas because in school, you know, Galileo is like this hero, like Columbus, you know, like it's crazy. And then they hear this, like, another person in a completely different perspective looking at the man and not too golden, you know. So another book I've started is Carlos Castaneda's Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge, I think. The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge. Yes, that is exactly what it is. And it's about this guy, and I don't know exactly where he's from, but he says, like, I feel like he mentions he's from South America, you know, but he was in America at the time, United States of America. And he ends up finding this guy named Don Juan, who's like in his 60s, and he's described as a Yaqui Indian. And a friend of him tells him to go talk to him, and he goes talk to him, and the guy basically shoves him off. And so Carlos just keeps going and wedging him and like, hey, can you talk to me about this? I'm really interested. And he's like, he keeps talking about peyote because he wants to know more about medicinal plants. And then over time, the dude, Don Juan, ends up like trying to, he's like, if you want to know about mezcal, you have to take it. And he's like, no, I just want to hear you talk about it. And the way that I do my things, I can just listen to you, and that's all I need to be able to get it out. And it's just insane because, you know, Don Juan is just like, no, if you really want to understand, it's different for every man. You have to live it. And so over months and months, like he ends up living with the dude for like years, like 4 years or something like that. But over months, he like finally, it's like, it's so random the way it's described. And a lot of people say the book is fiction, but I don't get that feeling. Maybe it's fictionalized, but I think it's based off of some real shit. And what he finally gets, like, it's like at the end of a long night, and they end up driving to some other dude's house, one of Don Juan's friends, and it's like described as like a really dirty house. Like I picture kind of like poverty, you know, like a lot of these people aren't in the best of straits, you know. And like the guy ends up giving him some of the peyote buttons, and Carlos is like, why can I, you just give me them? And he's like, well, somebody else has to, which is interesting. I wonder why Don Juan, as his teacher, wasn't able to provide his medicine. And I wonder if that was the same with Don Juan and his teacher. Because he describes this being like a bit of knowledge that's delineated down to prospective students. It's like almost like a disciple, you know? And so he ends up taking it, and he describes this like getting real weirded out, and I could just imagine just like being overwhelmed, you know, like right at the top of that Deem Peak. And when he is able to figure out what's going on, he describes getting water out of the water bowl and then playing with his dog, and his dog, he sees the water go into the dog's mouth and it travels through his veins, and he sees it paint this picture, and it falls out of his pores and makes this beautiful lit up mane. It's just this absolutely just beautiful hallucination is how he described it. And then like the next day he asked Don Juan, he's like, what happened to me? Like, you know, or am I okay? You know, like, and Don Juan goes like, yeah, you're fine. You just had some seizures. You know, it's just like, you almost bit your tongue off. You know, you shat yourself. You pissed on John's dog. It's just like, you were fine. I was confident. It's like, I knew you were gonna be okay. And that was just a really strange, you know, like, he's like, and he said, you were playing with Mescal, which is crazy. He said, like, that when he was playing with the dog, it wasn't the dog anymore, that the spirit of this drug had come into the dog, and it was a teacher, and that as a teacher, it could frolic in front of you and make you laugh, and it could be beautiful, or it could be dead serious and make you terrified and afraid. And, you know, that I kept thinking of some of the times that I've gone too far with Deem. You know, like, it's just a very fascinating story, and I'm intrigued, and I look forward to reading more. And then, you know, I started Stardust, which is a book by Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman's one of my favorites. He's a guy who wrote Coraline, if you've ever done it. It's a kid's book. It's a really great movie. It's pretty creepy. It's a very creepy kid's book. I read it to my son, and I don't think he got it, but I'm gonna read it to it again. And he wrote another kid's book called Odd and the Frost Giants, which is just fantastic. Just a great kid's book, and it's all about Norse mythology, and it's fantastic. And one of my favorites is American Gods. Moved me. The main character Shadow in that one was just fantastic. And the first one I read was Anansi Boys. He's an amazing guy, and he's an amazing speaker. There's another podcast. I want to name drop him, but I can't remember. But they got him on there talking to him, and he's describing when he's writing these narratives, how often he doesn't know what the characters are going to do next, and he's just like this place for them to do their work. It's like he's like a little universe, like the god of this world. He doesn't know what they're going to do because, like, even his creations have free will. And so he's like, oh, he'll be walking, be like, oh, that's how it ends. That's how I get it now. He's British, and, like, it's just fantastic. Most of his shit has been movified now. He's really big in screenwriting. He does a lot of impact on his stuff when he works. He is always there writing, influencing his stuff. He's super collaborative, and he's really good at changing his stuff enough. And I'm sure that I haven't watched any of the TV stuff, and I'm sure it's different enough, but unique enough to be almost its own story, even though it's based off these books, which is very cool. And yeah, I got a 3-day weekend. I might do a little psychedelic dalliance tonight. A little nervous. I've been just really frustrated and tense all day. I think it's because I've been using social media too much. Been having great conversations with people. I had a couple really, really good conversations on this group that I'm part of, Open Mind Spiritual Retreat, I think, run by this really cool dude named Jonathan Reed, and a lot of cool people. I'm also part of this Ram Dass group. I try to get on a couple of these weird spiritual groups. I think I need to find a new one because I'm getting in the woods. I need to start talking to different groups. Maybe I'll join a flat earth group. Just join something weird, listen to people. But like yesterday, I spent maybe 3 hours just straight typing people back. And it was cool. I had a lot of impact, a lot of people come back, and I felt like I was doing good work, and I felt like I was learning stuff myself, and I wasn't being too stern. I was rewarding myself gracefully. But I felt fatigued by the end of the day, and I was noticing myself misspelling words, and my ideas weren't even good. So there is this middle ground when expressing yourself and when doing service and reaching out to other people where you can't just sit there and respond. You know, you have to be able to have that meditative moment where you're just by yourself and you're able to think and you're able to digest. Because as long as you're just spitting constantly, it's almost like your engine's choking. You know, you can't accelerate because you're always just using it to export shit. And when you take that energy away from trying to push things out, that energy comes back and it helps you think, and you can think clearly more, and you can all your ideas get this life of their own, and you start to see things change inside yourself. But as long as you're exporting, you're sending out this material is already copyrighted, none of it has the ability to change. And I feel that is a major detriment to the process. And so I want to continue to be able to use social media like the way I do, and so I can be able to reach people and talk to people, and I want to be able to do speaking. But I like the idea of being able to do this podcast because I can speak and I can put it out, and I hope that people listen to it, but I don't have to respond every single time unless you want to get me back. And soon I'll set up some things. I'll make a work email. I guess you can just email my personal. My personal email is Brandon with an O, W as in walrus, V as in Victor, OGT at gmail.com. If you want to email at me at any time about anything, that's totally cool. I don't know when I'll ever get anything out there. I've got a couple interviews staged this weekend, and I'm really looking forward to them. Super cool stuff. I'm really excited to talk to these two guys. And hopefully I'll be able to get things out soon. I need to figure out how to make a package that I can make accessible. I'm just going to have to swallow the bullet and figure out Pandora. One of the people I'm interviewing, maybe I'll make that part of the interview. I'll just ask him a lot of questions about how to do that kind of stuff. Yeah, so I guess I'm going to end it with one of my favorite allegories that I like to use. And I'm currently, a good friend of mine told me to use it to give to people when I want art, when I'm trying to get people to make me stuff, just tell them a story so I don't tell them what colors to use and they can make whatever they want for me. But I call this the Garden of Belief. And so, all right, imagine this. You're walking down this path. It's kind of like, I never really envisioned what it looks like coming up on, but all of a sudden you enter this valley and it's just decadent. It's green. It's beautiful. Like the Garden of Eden, like the most, like a lush tropical forest, but that's not too colluded. So you can actually walk by it. Like everything has its own little space. Like each little tree, each little plant, there's shrubs, there's grasses, there's flowers, there's little big trees, small trees, like every single arrangement of just this myriad variety. And I guess I like plants because they're all stationary. But each plant has its own little location, and it's completely unique. And as you look upon some of these plants, you notice that not every plant is completely healthy. Not every plant is completely perfect. Some of the bottom branches of certain plants don't have access to the sunlight. And because of that, they wither, and the fruit doesn't ripen, and things drop early. And so not every plant's perfect. Not every body's perfect, obviously. Not anything is perfect. So as a seeker, you approach these plants and you find some that are gorgeous, and you pick the ripe fruit and you take it. And it's like, I have a basket, and I keep walking and I find another tree. And then I start to see other seekers, and I see other people, you know, with baskets walking. And then I hear somebody shouting loudly, and I look up and there's this tree, and there's a man or a woman sitting on top of a podium just yelling, "This is the only plant there is. No other plant exists. You know, this is it. You know, like all those other plants are fallacies, they're illusions. This is it." And like some, and then I start to see other criers around other trees where it's almost a war of access. And then there's people from one plant throwing rocks at others because they don't like the look of the other plant, even though it's all life and it's all beautiful and it all has ripe fruit to be picked and it all has dead branches withering away. And the seeker who's walking, the heart just drops, and he or she sees this basket of ripe fruit, and he sees all this beauty around him, and it just breaks the heart to know that some people won't give themselves access to go get more ripe fruit, and that they might be eating fruit from broken branches because they've not given themselves any opportunity or choice. Because there's a myriad world of belief out there, and if you haven't caught on yet, every plant is a segment, just like the beginning of the episode, every plant is a segment of belief, like a kingdom or an authority. And there's the tree of Christianity, but there's also sub trees around the tree of Christianity where all the different schools have grown, like an aspen tree as it sends out roots through footers. You know, like if you ever had an aspen tree, Odin, no. Each tree, each plant is a different font of belief. And like an aspen tree sends out footers, or a strawberry will send out its little, or if you've ever seen a spider plant, you know, that's what belief does too. Sometimes it'll sprout out new plants that are technically connected to the mother plant, but things change, and it slowly changes. And that little plant, even though it's connected, is unique in its own. And we have the ability to go and pick all the ripe fruit all everywhere. It's within our ability to go choose and build our own ideology. We don't have to take any horse pill. We don't have to take any prescription. We don't have to accept any placebo that doesn't make us move ourselves, that's pictured on a TV or a media channel. We have access to everything we need to make a beautiful world to see. And you can find beauty in a blank wall. Well, thank you for listening. I hope you have a wonderful evening. Until next time.